We left in the middle of the story last time, so we need to get back to this. First, actually, before the story, making sure to wish everybody a Purim Katan Sameach. Everybody, hopefully, will have some Hamantashen today. The supermarkets have been waiting for weeks for you to buy them, so you could have them today. You could have them tomorrow, Shushan Purim Katan. That's fine also. So we are in the latter half of chapter 3 of Malachim and the story of the two women. And we started on it last week, and now we're going to venture forward with it and try to get a full understanding of it. We introduced the story last time, noting that the standard read is that this story is a positive one for Shlomo. This is a story in which Shlomo demonstrates the wisdom that Hashem has given him. We did note, though, there are overtones to it, elements that seem to suggest or demonstrate an overreach by Shlomo. Rav Rabinovich, we read last time, pointed out that this story does not make it into Divrei Hayamim. Divrei Hayamim records Hashem giving Shlomo wisdom, but it doesn't mention this follow-up story. I should note, I only saw it after the shiur last week. Abarbanel has a different explanation for why it's omitted in Divrei Hayamim. That it's omitted in Divrei Hayamim because Shlomo has other stories in which his wisdom is even more amazing. So you didn't need to mention that one. I'm not buying it. Sorry. We don't get many illustrations of Shlomo's wisdom. We do get statements like he understood the trees and the birds and whatever. We, gave parables, but stories, not so much. In any case, we did a basic read-through of the story last time. Again, it was chapter 3, sentences 16 to 28, and the story began with the two women who are described as zonot. And again, we took that basically at face value. How they come before the king, and the plaintiff says, I gave birth to a baby, right? If you're following along in the text, you want sentence 17. She says, we were there in the house. I gave birth. On the third day after I gave birth, she gave birth as well. We are there. No one else is there in the house. And her son died. She lay on her son. And she got up during the night and she took my son from me while I was sleeping. And then I woke up early in the morning and wanted to nurse my son and he was dead. And then I went looking later on when there was light of day and I realized, no, wait a minute, that's not mine. That's actually hers. And the defendant replies saying, absolutely not. That's nonsense. She says in sentence 22, my son is the live one. Your son is the dead one. So Shlomo hears the women go back and forth. We noted last time that the women continue to speak, but Shlomo repeats their claims. And we said that the Yerushalmi says that Shlomo repeats their claims because a judge has to show understanding of the claims. So Shlomo repeats what they said. Dan Isaac Abarbanel said that Shlomo repeated the claims to say to the first one, to the plaintiff, you're giving me this whole long story about what happened. At the end of the day, it boils down to, you say this, she says that. Because you have no evidence, you have no witnesses, nothing else. So Shlomo orders the baby cut in half. I think I mentioned last time, people like to say on this story that Shlomo is following the laws of Bava Metzia, the Masechta that begins with a discussion of what happens if there's property that's in dispute and each one claims that it's theirs. The classic first Mishnah in Bava Metzia says two people are holding a garment, this one says it's all mine, that one says it's all mine, and the rule is you split it. However, on reflection, I realized that's incorrect. That's not what Shlomo is doing. Because this is not a case in which two people are holding something. This is a case in which one woman, the defendant, is holding something, and the plaintiff comes forward and says, that's mine. And the rule in such a case is, hamotzi mechavero alavaraya. You want to get something from somebody else, you have to prove you have the rights to it. So no, this is not a case of what's called mamon hamuto basafek cholkin. This is not a case of splitting it. That's not what Shlomo's doing. That's a side note. But let's look at the end of the story. And then we have to come back and understand what's really going on here. So we are up to sentence 26, right? 25 was when Shlomo said, cut the kid in two, give half to one, give half to the other. Vatomer ha'isha asher bna ha'chai el ha'melech. The woman whose son is the live one, we don't know, plaintiff or defendant, but the woman whose son is the live one says to the king, ki nichmeru rachameha al bina, her mercy was awakened for her son. Her mercy was heated up for her son. We noted last time the parallel to the parsha for which this is the Haftorah, where Yosef has this similar expression for his mercy for Binyamin. She says, no, Vatomer bi Adoni, please my master, tenu la es hayalud hachai, give him the live one. V'hameis al temisuhu, don't kill the baby. That's what she says. And she says, bi Adoni. So Abarbanel says, that doesn't mean please, it means let me suffer the punishment, let me suffer the loss, she gets to have the baby. Vizos omeres, and the other one says, gamli gamlach lo yiyeh gizoru. That's the way it goes. Cut the baby in half. You don't get, I don't get, and that's the way it is. And of course, when you read this, you have to shake your head, right? Like, wait, I don't understand. The first woman said, whoever first and second are in this doesn't matter. The first woman said to the other one, you get the baby. Why didn't the other one say, thank you very much, take the baby and go home? Like, what in the world is going on here? So if you take a look on the sheet, you see Radak. Radak says, Ma shalo lakha oso, achar she'acheres amra tenula, that she didn't take the baby when the other one said, give it to her. Ki yada'a ki merachemes alav omra. Merachmas alav, no, Rachamis probably, Alav Amra. Because she knew the other one was only saying it out of mercy for the child. V'chashva ki ha-melech lo yitnehu la. But she didn't think the king is actually going to give it to her. Radak says she doesn't expect the king to follow through. And that's why. We're going to come back to that, because there's another way to read the statement of the non-mother on this, but the simple approach Radak says is she hears the woman say give it to her, but she doesn't think the king is going to go along with it. It's still problematic though, right? Like, still, how could anybody say cut the baby in half? So Abarbanel floats an interesting idea here, building on the same idea as Radak. He says, Lefisha chashva shamelech lo yiteno so eleha. I see your hand, Ricky. Abarbanel says, she thought the king is not giving her the baby. V'gam hayeled achareichein tamid yisapek biyoso bina v'bnei zeh machlokas asher es parsein. This kid, if she actually gets the baby, is going to grow up thinking, I don't know if this is really my mother, because everybody knows this story of the two zonot who went before the king. The kid is going to grow up thinking, is she my mother? Is she not my mother? She doesn't want to go through the trouble of raising him, knowing that then he could just walk away and say, you're not my mother. So therefore she says, let's just get rid of him. I find it to be an interesting idea. Absolutely not pshat in the story. It doesn't really hold water. But it's an interesting idea nonetheless that Abarbanel is suggesting here, that maybe it's that she's afraid that she's going to raise him and then he's going to abandon her. So either way, Vayan HaMelech, sentence 27, the king responds, Vayomer, and he said, Tenu la es hayalud hachai, give her the living one, meaning her, the one who said, don't cut the baby. V'hameis lo simisuhu, don't kill him. He, imo, she is his mother. V'yishmeu kol Yisrael es ha-mishpat asher shafat ha-melech, and everybody hears the judgment that the king has issued. V'yireu mipnei ha-melech, they were in awe of the king. Ki ra'u ki chochmas elokim b'kirbo la'asos mishpat. They say, oh, this king's smart, this one. He's got wisdom from God. He is the one who can carry out justice. Okay, we have a lot of questions that we have to address here. So I'm going to do a few, and then, Ricky, you can have a chance. But I want my questions first. So, first of all, I can't tell who the mother is in this story. I can't tell if it's the plaintiff or if it's the defendant. I feel like we're playing a little bit of a shell game here, kind of swapping them around the story. That's one problem. I have another problem. This sword trick. Why didn't the mothers know that this was a trick? Right? At the least, the one who says, split the kid in half. Like, you couldn't have figured that out? Like, did this really make Shlomo smarter than anybody else? I tried this test. I told the story to my youngest, who had heard bits and pieces of the story before, but you know, he was hearing it, like, told straight here. And he had the same reaction. Like, wait, really? She got fooled into saying that? How does that make any sense? It's bizarre. And we're not the first ones to be bothered by this. If you take a look at source number 3 on the sheet, a tshuva, a responsum by Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra, also known as Radbaz. Radbaz, as you see there, is 16th century Spain / Egypt / Israel. Sha'alta mimeni, he begins his response to somebody by recapping the question. You asked me, you did nefesh, you did nafshi, my beloved friend. Al ha-mishpat she-shafat Shlomo bein shtei hanashim zonot. This judgment that Shlomo did between the two women. Uma ha-chochma, I skipped a little bit in the question. Uma ha-chochma ha-yesera she-yesh be-mishpat hazeh. What great wisdom was there in this judgment of Shlomo? Ein zakim tachbulam and tachbulot. He came up with a strategy. You have one strategy, you have another strategy. We have judges who can do things like this. Like, this demonstrates that Shlomo is so much better than anybody else. And his response to the question is, yeah, you're right. Tshuva. Yafa sha'alta. You ask well. Ukvar kidamcha Rabbi Yitzchak Abar Benel. Abar Benel asked the question before you. And he says, yeah, but Abar Benel's answer is wrong. You can go read his book if you want his answer. His answer is wrong. I'm going to go give you other answers, Radbaz says. But is it, I mean, come on. This is not a world-beating trick. And again, why in the world does the non-mother think that that saying, you know, kill the baby makes any sense at all? We've given answers already. But, you know, it's hard. Honestly, this question is the one question there that I really think can't be answered. Meaning all the answers I've given don't adequately address this one of why the other woman says it. And my answer would be on that, you know, on that point that this goes back to, I'm muting everybody to avoid background noise. This actually goes back to the medrash that we saw last time. You may recall that we saw a medrash that suggested that this whole story is a setup. These are not two real women. Rather, these are two ruchos, two angelic spirits of some kind. God wants to put on a show to demonstrate Shlomo acting as a good judge, and so it's a setup. No human being would actually say, sure, cut the baby in half. It's just such a strange thing. Okay, I am now going to take your questions. If your question is the same as one of those that I already asked, please just, you know, don't say me too. I'm looking for new questions and new thoughts and new issues. Ricky, you've been waiting the longest. Go ahead.
Is there a chance that what these women say is being reported in the wrong order?
Nope. No, because I said this last time, this is Rabbi Shalom's point. The fact that the text reports their words and then says after that, and they spoke before the king, means the text wants us to understand these words as their actual words, the way they said them. Yeah, it would be convenient if we could flip the order. That I definitely agree with. Okay, Ellen, you were waiting next. I'm going in order of the people I saw. Nope, Ellen says no, not me. Okay, Rebecca, you were going to say? Then Ruchama after that.
I'm not quite, maybe I'm missing something. How does making these people angels make this more believable?
Because if it's just a pantomime, right? If this is just a play in order to show Shlomo being wise and figuring things out, So they're playing a part, and one of them saying, no, cut the baby in half, just serves to illustrate, you know, what Shlomo has already figured out.
Yes, but we, the reader, are reading it and going, I don't think it was just done, I mean, this wasn't recorded for just the moment, or if it was happening, this is for posterity, and I read it and say, I don't know. For me,
I understand.
That doesn't resonate.
No, I definitely hear you. That leads into the broader question of biblical stories and how much of them is intended for the moment when they take place and how much of it is intended for posterity. It's a good question. Ruchama. I don't hear you. You're not muted. You're not muted. I just don't hear you. Something's wrong with your microphone. Yeah, no, something's wrong with the microphone there. You should try testing the microphone. There's an option on Zoom to do test speaker and microphone. Try that, please. And that should work. If you're losing a computer as opposed to an iPad, look where it says mute. There's a little arrow. There you should choose test speaker and microphone. Susan and then Moish.
I was wondering why they used the Zonah. Could it be because they didn't want husbands involved?
So the Zonah identity is definitely a key part of this story. Certainly it's true that it helps explain why there's nobody else around, right? There's no husband involved whatsoever. There's no father who's willing to acknowledge that he is the father of any of the babies. So it makes it a cleaner story in that regard. We saw last week, I think it was a Bar Vinel, but I'm not sure, who said that it makes Shlomo's deduction more impressive, because the Zonot are well aware of and well practiced in boldly saying whatever they want to say, and people believe them. So it makes it more interesting that Shlomo is able to figure this out. But what we're going to see when we get to Rabbi Ed Shalom's reading of the story is he believes that that's actually fundamental to the entire story. So wait. No, that there's no notes. You'll see.
Oh, okay.
You'll see. Very interesting read. Moish.
I'm going to suggest something that's really quite remarkable.
Okay.
And I'm surprised that I hadn't heard any mention of it.
Okay.
If you look at what the women gave as evidence, there is one woman, and let's just say that it's the same woman, who consistently focuses on the dead one.
Oh, we're getting there. We're getting there.
So I think what happened is that Shlomo picked up on that and said, well, that's good enough for me, but I'm going to prove that.
Yeah, we're getting there. Malbin picks up on that. You are very right. It is definitely a point in this. We're going to go back to Ruchama. Hopefully your mic is working now. Nope, still don't hear you. I'm sorry. Janine, and then Toby.
Okay, you know, there's a joke told about Russians. I'll try to make it really, really short, like out all the stuff that makes it funnier, but a peasant that has a horrible shoe of a wife and terrible lands and daughters that are mean and whatever, no joy in life, and a genie comes and says, I'll give you a wish, and he says, you see that peasant over there, he has a beautiful, wonderful, supportive wife and wonderful daughters who have given him grandchildren and wonderful lands and crops, and he's wealthy. Oh, genie, make him like me.
Right.
He's told about the Russians. I sometimes think it's about Canadians. And I think it's almost like if her child died, like, she doesn't care about the child. Just make her as a...
I hear you. I hear you, but it's just so bizarre when you've been offered the live one. You know what I mean? It's just, I hear the joke, but there's a reason why we react to the joke that way, because it's just so glaring, you know?
But there are people that...
There are people like that. That is true. Toby, you were going to say?
Let's assume that these are real women. You know, they're not, spirits or a story. Their credibility was underlined in the very beginning when they were labeled Zonot. So why wouldn't we assume that it's the psychopath who's the mother, the one who says, cut the child in half? We don't actually know who's the mother. It could be either one of them.
So, right. So once you label one of them as a psychopath...
So don't have no credibility, so you can't... you're going to assume they have no credibility. Nothing even one of them says is true.
So what, I hear what you're saying, but I don't know that that's going to fit the story, because again, the story begins with one of them losing her kid and taking the other one's baby, assuming that this is, you know, what actually happened. If you're going to go to that trouble of substituting and so on, you're not going to then kill the kid. It just doesn't make any sense. Unless your argument is it's the other way around. But if it's the other way around, then this is the woman who went to court in front of the king to get the kid back. She's not going to say kill it. I hear what you're saying in terms of them having their credibility undermined by being given this label. It didn't begin by saying they're women. It began by saying they're zonot. At the same time, I have a hard time just, the logical flow isn't there. So let's look at some evidence. Evidence is good. Oh, Sandra, yes.
Yeah, so what happened to the dead baby? Did they bury it, or?
Hopefully. Do they have it there right now?
Pardon?
You're asking if they have it there right now.
Yeah, like she's claiming that she slept on the baby and smothered it.
Right.
Would they know whether the baby was smothered, or is that part of the story?
Coming back to it. Good question. Coming back to it. Ricky, I see your hand, but I want to go further because we're not running this story into next week. I don't know what you're pointing at.
1 minute. I think the fact that there's a lot shows that Shlomo listens to everyone, not just important people, but also I think it makes his look good.
And we pointed out last week that that's the nature of access in general, the kings in Tanakh, is that people are able to get before the king, including people who really have no business there. But we're going to come back to that idea also. Let me go further, please. So some bits of evidence that lead in different directions here. First of all, I want to point out sentence 18. Right now we're just doing evidence, and then we're going to come to ideas that tie everything together. But I want to show you some things in the Psukim. Sentence 18, we said, and we stressed, there's nobody else in the house. Ein zar itanu babayit. There's nobody else around. So Rabbi Ed Shalom, and I gave you a link in source number 4 where you could hear his presentation on it. It's a short presentation. I definitely recommend hearing it. I don't agree with everything in there, but there's an awful lot there that I think is very useful. He says, business is bad for the zonot. They just spent 9 months being pregnant, and then they gave birth within 3 days of each other. Having kids around now is not going to improve matters for them, right? I'll add to Rabbi Ed Shalom's point. Do you remember when we learned back in the story of Rachav in Yehoshua? This is a very long time ago, those of you who learned it with me in the Thursday shiur. We noted that Rachav, when she talks about saving her family, right, she said to the spies, my father, my mother, my siblings, she doesn't have children. Because that's the nature of the trade. So, Rabbi Ed Shalom says, having kids around is bad for business. Is there an incentive to get rid of the children? Hold that thought as we go further. That was one piece of evidence that's worth noting. Second piece of evidence that's worth noting. Sentence 22. We said that the plaintiff gave a whole long story. I gave birth, 3 days later she gave birth, and during the night she lay on her baby and then went to get mine and all that. The defendant, on the other hand, is very brief in sentence 22. She just says, Lo chi, b'ni ha-chai u'v'nei ha-meit. That's it. We got what? 6 words. Right? About the same number as Eov's wife in that book, right? If you remember, those who did Eov together. It's not so. The living son is mine. My son is the live one. Your son is the dead one. And that's all she's gonna say. So Abarbanel says, aha, she's the guilty one. She doesn't want to trip herself up by talking too much. If you take a look at source number 5, Abarbanel is playing detective. V'siper ha-kosev she-ha-isha ha-nit-ba'as lo ratzta la-harboz bidvarim penti kashel bidvareha. She didn't want to go on at length because she's worried she's going to say something incriminating. She might contradict herself. Better that I don't say anything. Abarbanel knew a lot about palace intrigue and plots, and I wonder how much of that is informed with this. We noted as well, and I said this last time, but I'll repeat it, in sentence 22, it says, they spoke before the king, which Rabbi Yet Shalom points out means that everything else we've seen here is a literal quote, which is going to matter as we parse the words the way that Moish tried to, because Malbim, as well as Rabbi Yet Shalom, point out in opposite ways that the women say flipped things regarding the babies. If you look carefully at the language, the language in sentence 22, the defendant says, "Bini hachai uvneich hamet." My son is the live son, your son is the dead son. And then it continues. The other one, the plaintiff said, "Bineich hamet ubini hachai." Your son is the dead one, my son is the live one. And then Shlomo repeats their words, and he's so careful. He says, "Zosomeres zebni achai uvnei chames." This one says, "This live one is mine. Your son is the dead one." And this one says, "Lochi bnei chames uvnei achai." He flips it the same way that they did. Instead of saying it in the efficient way of each of you say bnei achai uvnei chames, he doesn't. He uses the same words that they did. One says, my son is the live one, yours is the dead one. And the other one says, your son is the dead one, my son is the live one. You're going to see Malbim and Rabbi Yet Shalom learn opposite lessons from this. But both of them point out that it has to be on purpose. Finally, Radbaz notes there's an extra word in that sentence. If you look carefully at sentence 23, Shlomo says, Zos Omeris, this one says, Zebini hachai ubnei chames. This living one is mine. But when he says the other one's words, he drops the word ze. Vezos omeres lo ki bnei chames ubnei chai. There's no word ze. It's only when he quotes the one, not when he quotes the other. So with all of this evidence and with all of this discussion, what in the world is really happening in this story? So I gave you a table after source number 5, just to show you the range and give you a quick reference summary for all the approaches. You can see that the commentators are split on the question of whether it is the plaintiff who wins or whether it is the defendant who wins. We have 3 votes here for the defendant, 2 votes here for the plaintiff, and we're going to see, as I put in the third column, that Shlomo's judgment is based in the wording according to the first 2 approaches there. The wording plus the sword test is the third approach. And then the last 2 say, no, it has nothing whatsoever to do with the words or the sword at all. We're going to go through this one by one. Okay? Ready?
Good. I just want to know if you can hear me now.
I hear you now, Ruchama. Mazal tov. I'm very glad. Good. You can you celebrate Purim Katan now. So, first approach on our list. This is the approach of Malbim, as well as Rabbi, I don't know if he's rabbi, I think he's rabbi, Ephraim Yehuda Wiesenberg, in an essay that's available online. And that is that Shlomo figured it out based on their words. The sword test was just in order to make his conclusion obvious to the people in front of him, but he got it from their words. Malbim first. Malbim, as I noted for you, picks up on the fact that that Shlomo repeats their words. Take a look at source number 6. He says, Sipera katuv, the text informed us, ki bedabram, when they spoke, amrahanit bat b'lashon b'ni achai v'nei chameis. The defendant said, my son is the live one, your son is the dead one. V'hatovas amra behefech. Whereas the plaintiff said the opposite. B'nei chameis, b'nei achai. Your son's the dead one, my son is the live one. Uklal b'lashon. He says, here's a rule with people's language. Shaha adam yachdim tamid mashahu ha'ikar. V'acheret hatafel. The first thing that you mention is the thing that matters to you, and then afterwards you get to the other things. He's never been in a shiur of mine, right, where the first answer is the one I like least. But nonetheless, that's what Malvin says. He says the first thing that you emphasize, that's really what you're into. Ulefi zeh svara nosenes shehaisha hadishdikala habdim b'lashona b'ni hachai kodem ikar magamasa sheyeh hachai b'na. The one who said first, the living one's my son, her focus was that point. The living one is mine. Whereas the other one who said first, your son's the dead one. Her main goal was, the dead one is yours. Not that she gets the live one. And it's based on that, that Shlomo makes the deduction, and the sword thing is just to play it out. That is Malvin. Rabbi Dr. Wiesenberg, in source number 7, takes a Columbo approach. I don't know how many people here are Columbo fans, but I remember my grandmother showing me Columbo. So this is very much a Columbo strategy. He says, and you can imagine Shlomo with his one hand on the doorknob as he's about to leave and saying, I just have one more question.
Right.
So he says, Hashela misoreres miyad. The question that arises immediately is, Hishayim haisa yeshena, if she was sleeping, the plaintiff, right? I was sleeping when that happened. Ketzad hi yodas b'dyukes kol ma'aseh shel isha ha'acheres, she koreis la bebuz ha'isha hazos. How did she know with such precision, right? She lay on the baby, and the baby died, and she went and took mine. She tells this whole story about this woman who she says, you know, very scornfully, that woman. Bishlam abesof dvoreha. It's fine with what she said at the end. Vatikaches bina etzli. She took my son from me. That she could know. Evshar lehamlitz ba'ada she mishaeres shamaaseh muchrach hayaliyos kafi shesibra. That you could assume. That, you know, that's the only conclusion she could draw. This woman took the baby from me. Sha'arei, because after all, ain zari tana b'bayis, there's nobody else around. Vimlo hi achlif v'shnei ladim azai mi hichlif. If this woman didn't do it, then who else did it? Aval ta'ana sa neged osaha isha shabipshia sahi hemisa ez bina. But the statement that the other woman was careless, and that's how the baby died, if you were sleeping, how did you know that any of that happened? So he says, that's how Shlomo pinpoints the liar. And again, the sword thing is just to demonstrate it to the world. So those are our first two approaches. According to Malbim, going back to our table, it's the defendant who wins because she says, my son is the live one. That's what she emphasizes. And according to Rav Wiesenberg, it's the defendant who wins because she's the only one whose story could actually have been, a genuine report. That brings me to approach number 2 overall. And that is Rabbi Eich Shalom. He says the brilliance of Shlomo was in understanding the words, but it's not just about that. It's understanding the nature of the zonot. Now, I have to tell you right as I introduce this idea, I think that it's a fanciful idea. I think it's cool. I think that it's not pshat. But it's a great read. It really is a great read. He says, look, and I didn't bring it on the sheet because it's from the audio. I wasn't going to sit there transcribing it. I apologize, but you have the link. He says, business is bad because of the pregnancies and the children, right? Like we noted before. It's so bad that the defendant killed the baby. It wasn't an accident. It was on purpose. If you go back to the sentence, everybody reads the sentence the way that we did. The claim is, asher shachva alav, you know, she was lying there during the night and the baby died. It's sentence 19. He says, no. This is an accusation. The plaintiff is saying she killed her baby. And then she went to get mine and she planned to do the same thing to my baby. That's the accusation that's being made in sentence 19. And he says, I'm not taking questions or comments till I get through this. And that, he says, is the reversal of the wording. Just like Malbim picked up on the reversal of the wording, so Rabbi Etshalom contends the opposite approach. He says, when you're talking to a judge, you want the judge to remember your key point, that's what you say last. That's what you want to have the judge thinking about when you finish talking. So he says, the main thing for the plaintiff is to say, my kid is alive. The main thing for the defendant is your child is dead. And Shlomo notices that, which is why he repeats it. The defendant wants the child to be dead. And Shlomo's brilliance, according to Rabbi Etshalom, is that even though Shlomo is a king, who was born into the family of a king, he understands the world of the Zonot, and he understands the accusation. And so he comes up with the sword test. The test is, if the defendant really wants the baby dead, the defendant is going to jump at the chance to have me take care of it. Right? I'll eliminate the baby, and then she has no more problems. And that's what she does. I still am bothered, because I still am bothered by, would she really be foolish enough to say kill the baby? But that's Rabbi Etshalom's read of the story, is that the sword test is a way to prove that that this is actually a murderer and the whole thing wasn't an accident in the first place. That's our second approach. Yes, Rebecca.
Makes no sense, because then it assumes that the woman who wants both of them dead has some sort of prophecy and knows that Shlomo is going to come up with a solution like this. When she came forward and claimed the live child,
it's the other way around. It's the other way around. The way that Rabbi Etshalom is reading the story is that the plaintiff, the one who comes forward initially, is the innocent one. The defendant is the guilty one. And the defendant's plan was, let me get the baby and I'll smother it myself a day later, 2 days later. But then when Shlomo makes the offer, she says, oh great, let him do it. Not that she anticipated what Shlomo was going to do.
Far-fetched.
Yeah, no, like I said in the beginning, it's a fanciful approach, but I have to give him points for creativity. It's a great read. That's all I'm saying. Moish. You're muted. Moshe is muted. And then Ruchama.
There we are. I'm really upset with this version by Rabbi Etshalom. And it's clear that he's never been in a Beit Zonot.
I hope that's true.
But seriously, he's got it exactly wrong. It says that there's nobody else in the Beit Zonot but them, which tells him that it is not a brothel. Because in a brothel, you're busy at night. We know that from the story of Rahab. We know that from anybody who has sense. The term Zonot is not about prostitutes. This is a home for unwed mothers. And that's what they're talking about. They've been deserted by the people who they had relationships with. And they were abandoned.
I'm going to give you points for creativity also. We're going to split the points.
Okay. We have a brothel with no customers in it.
Okay. We have more to see here, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. Hang on there, Rose.
No, that's why there was two of them.
Hang in there.
I said, you said there was no business.
Yeah.
Business was bad.
Yeah.
There you go. That's why there was only two of them. They had nothing to do.
Right. So I'm inclined to think that. Ruchama, and then we're going to go to the third approach.
Okay, so maybe I missed it the few minutes when I reconnected. When I read the pasuk 23, זאת אומרת בני החי ובני חמת, וזאת אומרת לא כי בני חמת.
Yeah, we talked about that.
So she really concentrated not on the one that is really alive, but on the one that is dead, so which really put her that she really does not so much cares about her high.
Right, that was right.
That, dead one.
Right, so that was what we had noted. We had two different ways to read it. Rabbi Ed Shalom said what they say first is what really matters to them. And, I'm sorry, that was Malbim's approach. Rabbi Ed Shalom suggested you're talking to a judge, what you say at the end is what really matters to you and what you want the judge to hear. I could hear either argument. Alright, let's talk about approach number three. I'm gonna mute everybody so I can get to approach number three. I apologize, but there's just too much here. And we're not doing this story another week. This is the story. So, approach number three, or school number three, is Shlomo's brilliance is that he knows, having nothing to do with their words, and having nothing to do with the sword. The point of the test is to make his answer obvious to everyone. Take a look at Abarbanel in source number 8. He says, Ukvar kasavti lamala b'shar hasheni amitas ha'enyin hazeladati. Remember I told you about his 12,000 word manuscript on the wisdom of Shlomo and what it was and what it wasn't and all that. So in the second gate of that piece, he already explained, and here he's just summarizing. V'usha Shlomo hisig amitas hadavar hazeh kodem hanisayon v'abachina hazos. Shlomo grasped the truth of the matter before there was any test, before there was any sword. And he says, Ki mehakaras p'nei hanashim hazonos umipartsu feihen. By recognizing the faces of the women, and their features, kishayim vahem, when he examined them, va'ofen divrehem kishashamau son, and the way of their words when he heard them. He sig matzbune libo son viarad le'emes ha'inyan. He understood what was in their hearts. He grasped the truth. V'gilali yoshvim lefanav tochen ha'inyan ve'imuto kfi ma shehik sig b'chochmaso mipartzufei anashim v'osos divrehen utinuoseyen. And he revealed to those who were sitting in front of him the contents of it and the truth of it as he had grasped it just by looking at them and the way they moved. Ha'omnam asah b'china ha'hi b'hem sh'haro'im ha'yoshvim b'rishna b'malchut lefanav yakiru chochmaso. The whole thing with the sword was just in order to show everybody, look, I am right. Abarbanel says, the clues that Shlomo picked up on are not in the text. And honestly, that makes the most sense to me in this entire story. Because we keep trying to put ourselves in Shlomo's shoes. But by definition, he has been introduced to us as smarter than all of us. So why in the world should we think that we're going to figure out what he figured out? I think Abarbanel is 100% right. I think that we're pretending to be the smartest of all, and no, it's because this one was first and that word was there and whatever. That's not what did it. It was something that you're not even privy to. That's the idea. Chana, I'm going to ask you to wait because I want to do Radbaz. Radbaz is a similar approach, even though he says he doesn't like Abarbanel's approach. He thought Abarbanel was wrong. But he gives you a similar idea that it's based on features. But look what he does. He says, I'm going to go with my English translation just because there's a lot of text here. It appears to me, he says, that King Solomon identified the mother of the child from a few points. First, he recognized that the features of the living child resembled the features of the plaintiff. This takes me back to Sandra's question. Is the dead baby present? So according to Radbaz, they're looking at the living child, and they're looking at the plaintiff, and they're looking at the deceased child also. And the features of the deceased child resemble the features of the woman who held the living child. So he says, mm-mm, I looked at them. I know already by appearances, I can tell. I don't know how in the world he can tell. I don't know how old these babies are. We know that one of them is at least 3 days old, but beyond that, we don't have enough to work with. He also recognized the nature of the plaintiff. She made small motions. She was energetic and careful. She did not lie on her child. He recognized the other woman was the opposite. One looked like she was like very on the ball, very sharp, and the other one seemed a little bit slower. He judged the deceased child was hers. And therefore the king judged, this was her son, and he told those who stood beside him, this is the son of this one, this is the son of this one. And to clarify the matter, so that they would believe this was so, he performed this strategy to test it. And so they knew that the king had spoken truly. At the outset, he did the sword thing in order to show everybody that what he was saying was correct. And then he tells you something else here, which honestly, I didn't quite grasp, but keep on reading. He says that even though the text does not say this explicitly, it doesn't give us the deduction, it doesn't have Shlomo say, hey, look at these one, this one's features and all that, the text is normally concise. And one may deduce it from when it says, and they stood before the king. Right? That's where, you know, the text included that point, is they spoke before the king, actually. Is that me or is that him? Vata'amod and Vata'daber. Where did you, I'm just looking at what I translated. No, it says Vata'amodna. Okay. He said, it says they stood before the king, which appears entirely extra. It comes to say they stood before him for some time, and he looked at that time and recognized the verdict before they spoke. He looks at them and he says, I know which one is the real one. And then he says that word zeh that I pointed out before, this. He says, and so one may deduce from the king's statement. This one says, and I underlined the word zeh, this is my living son, and your son is the dead, etc. Even though our sages taught, from here we learn that a judge must repeat the claims of the litigants, like I quoted before from the Yerushalmi, he should have said, this one says my son is the living and your son is the dead, as he said for the other. Why did he include the word this is? What's the this is? And even if you wish to say that he said this to point with his finger, which was unnecessary, still he said it out of place. The word ze is out of place. He should have said, this one says, this living one is my son. Therefore, I say that to the people who stood with their faces toward the woman who held the boy, this one says, this is my living son. And this is not true, for this is not her son, but rather the dead one. In other words, he used the word this to say, she's claiming this, and actually it's that. That's the way that that Radbaz says it. Like I said, I raced through that last point because I don't really grasp what he did with that. But his main point is he is in camp with Abarbanel. There were things Shlomo observed, and that what was led him to the conclusion. As I said last time, there's this other idea that Radbaz has, the Meiri and Yevamos talks about it, that there were Yevamot. I'm not going into that. It's too labyrinthine, and I think we've done enough labyrinthine. But what emerges here, and what I hope we understand, is that you have three basic schools of thought. One school of thought is, he got it from their words, whether it's the way that they flipped, my child is the live one versus your child is the dead one, or the fact that the plaintiff tells a story she could not have been privy to. Your second approach, Rabbi Ed Shalom's approach, it's the words plus the test. He figures out based on the words, and he understands the story, but the test is critical for determining that he's really right in his read. Or the third approach, which is Shlomo didn't even get it from the words. He got it by looking at them. Questions and comments before we continue with this. So there's a question in the chat, who is the plaintiff and who is the defendant? So go back to the original story and you'll see the plaintiff is the one who comes to Shlomo in the, oh, no one can see it, it's just to me. The plaintiff is the one who comes to Shlomo and says, that woman is holding my live baby. That's the plaintiff. The defendant is the woman who is holding the live baby. That's the idea. Yeah. Questions and comments. I have more to say, but I want to make sure to take questions and comments on these approaches now before we go further. Nope? Okay. So, what are we supposed to take away from this story? So, first of all, the point is clearly not the story itself and its verdict. The fact that the text doesn't bother to tell us who won, I think it is indicative of the fact that we don't really care who won. It's not about the plaintiff and it's not about the defendant. certainly, whether I take the story positively as a statement that Shlomo is wise, or a warning that Shlomo is going to become arrogant, the story is meant to show his wisdom comes from God. And the Gemara picks up on two words in this story. When Shlomo gives the verdict, go back to sentence 27. The king declares, Tenula es hayalud hachai. Give her, whoever her is, the live one. Vehameis lo simisuhu. Do not kill him. He imo. She is his mother. You don't need those last two words in the sentence. You already said, give her. Right? Why do you add the words, she is his mother? Take a look at the Gemara in Makos in source number 10. The Gemara says there were three times in which we find in Tanakh Ruach HaKodesh in a Beit Din. We actually learned this, if I remember correctly, in, maybe it was when Yonasan and David in the Thursday afternoon class, when Yonasan and Shaul, when Yonasan is going to get killed for eating during the battle in chapter 14. But either way, the point that's relevant for us, Hofia Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration was manifest of Beis Dino Shel Shlomo, in Shlomo's court. Dichsiv, because the text says, Vayana Melech Vayomer, the king declared and he said, give her the living child, don't kill him, she is his mother, Menayada. How did Shlomo know? Dilma Iyaruma Me'arma, like we've already said. Anybody could figure out what this test was about. Both mothers should have known that the thing to do is to say, don't split the baby. So how do you deduce anything from this story? The Gemara says you can't deduce anything from that story. But Yatzasa bas kol v'amra, hi imo. A voice came out from heaven confirming that Shlomo was correct, saying, she is his mother. In other words, God declared it. And that goes back to Abarbanel's idea that all of Shlomo's wisdom is revelation from God. Now, whether we accept the idea that Shlomo's request for wisdom was a dark request, right? I want to know how to judge between good and bad, like the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and the idea that he's trying to judge cases himself, which even Moshe couldn't do. Whether you accept that, whether you accept Rabbi Et Shalom, not Rabbi Et Shalom, sorry, Rabbi Rabinovich's approach, the story doesn't appear in Divrei Hayamim, we can see one thing clearly, which is Shlomo doesn't do what Yosef and Daniel did. Right? I brought you source number 11, I didn't bring you the actual psukim, but you can look them up. The first is that when Yosef interprets dreams, he says, this is coming from Hashem, right? Asher halokim oseh, hera is paro, but he says, halole lokim pistronim, that's the line. He says, explanations for these things come from God, not from me. Daniel does the same thing. In chapter 2 of Daniel, the king had his, Nebuchadnezzar had his dream, and nobody could explain it, and the king didn't even tell anybody what the dream was. The advisors are expected to tell him what he dreamed and what it meant, and everybody else has no idea what to do, and the king is killing advisors. And Daniel steps up and he explains it, but he says, this is from Hashem. And Shlomo doesn't do that. And that fits in with a comment, I see you, Gita, but I just wanted to finish the thought. That fits in with a comment from Rav Rabinovich. Take a look, please, at source number 12. I quoted his essay last week. I'm quoting another piece of the essay this week, as translated by Ellie Fisher. The sages have already addressed this puzzle and illuminated a path to understanding that precisely what seems to be the supreme expression of a, quote, wise and discerning mind was not simply a gift from God, and it in fact pushed him into the abyss of destruction. This was a bad thing, giving Shlomo this wisdom. The sages said Kohelet, who is Shlomo, sought to pronounce judgment based on intuition, without witnesses and without admonition. A heavenly, meaning without any warning to the party who commits the crime. In halacha, we require eidim v'hasra'a, witnesses and a warning. And Shlomo said, nah, I don't need that. I can figure out whether they knew what they were doing and so on. A heavenly voice issued forth and said to him, and that which he, God, wrote is upright and true, which is a verse in Koheles. By the mouth of two witnesses, Shlomo wanted, and the emphasis is in the original, Shlomo wanted to circumvent the Torah's demands with his wisdom. It was not with divine wisdom that he sought to do so. Wisdom has its own dark drives. And he quotes our Gemara. The sages even found fault with the wisdom of Shlomo's judgment regarding the identity of the mother of the live child. How did he know? Maybe she was duping him, right? That's our Gemara that we said. Maybe that she was playing a trick. The wisest of all men wished to go beyond the boundaries of human intelligence and liberate himself from the shackles of mitzvot, which are merely the tools with which the body confines the soul. But that was not the intent of the prophecy, and so there is no place for the story of Shlomo's judgment in Divrei Hayamim. We must look to the book of Malachim to understand Shlomo's seemingly split personality, where on the one hand he's beloved of God, builder of the temple, and on the other hand, he has these failings. We're going to come back to this essay, God willing, when we get to chapter 10, chapter 11 in Malachim, and we find Shlomo making further mistakes. But right now, the key point that I want to show you is, we take away from this Shlomo's wisdom, but we also take away from this, potentially, his weakness. And he doesn't credit God, and he won't. As the chapters continue and he's wowing people with his wisdom, he's never going to say, this is all from Hashem. Concluding note on this, and then I'll take Gita's comment. Source number 13, Radak comments on the verse that said at the end of the story that everybody was amazed and they revered Shlomo and all that. Radak says, Lefichach yar'u mipanav la'asos devar rava afilu b'seser. I think I referenced it last week, but I'm bringing it back here at the end of the story. Because of this, because they saw Shlomo's wisdom, they were afraid to do anything bad, afilu b'seser, even in private. They saw that in his great wisdom, he could bring justice to light. As happened in his legal decision. And my point here in bringing this is, go back to the why Hashem offered Shlomo everything in the first place. One explanation was, in order to help him usher in the utopia he's supposed to introduce, to build the temple, to wow everybody, that's what he's supposed to do. Giving him wisdom like this is meant to be a step towards that. That's how, yeah, and that's what it succeeds in doing. It intimidates everybody. I'm not going to get out of line if I know the king can figure me out. Gita, you were going to say.
Yes, the little phrase, made law to me too.
Yeah.
That is a form of, not Melissa, but that's a strange sentence. The dead isn't going to be killed.
No, because it's not the dead. Hamet is the verb. Hamet is not ham. It's hamet. It's a comma. It's under the hay. It's hamet lo to me too, who means don't go, don't carry out an execution.
Oh, hamet lo to me too. I got it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay. I gave you at the end of the sheet a set of 10 review questions for chapter 3. Obviously, it's 229. We're not going through them right now. But everything going back to the marriage to the daughter of the paro, continuing through his use of the minor altars, Shlomo as a Navi or not as a Navi, the whole bit. Hopefully it'll be somewhat useful for you, because we have to start on chapter 4, which is going to introduce a problem right at the outset. Because if you look at chapter 4, sentence 1, it says, Vayi HaMelech Shlomo Melech al kol Yisrael. Shlomo was king over all Israel. Which is an important statement to make. Such an important statement that it already said it in chapter 2, sentence 12, and in chapter 2, sentence 46. So why in the world are you telling me again that Shlomo is king over Israel? And we will start with that, God willing, next week. Thank you very, very much, everyone.
And can I ask just one question?
Yes, Susan.
You compared Shlomo to Moshe, but in Moshe, if I recall...
When did I compare Shlomo to Moshe?
I thought you were judging. Didn't you say Moshe?
I said Shlomo said, you know, he wants to judge everybody's cases, and Moshe had said, I can't do that. Yeah.
No, because Moshe did judge still, but only the important ones.
Right, he doesn't try to judge everyone. Yeah, that's the difference.
That's what I didn't understand.
Okay. Ricky, you were going to say?
Yes. What is the explanation for Shlomo for not acknowledging God
he's so smart, he should know
because
that's required of him.
So, you know, I'm not, I hate being in the position of judging someone in Tanakh. They're in Tanakh and I'm not. At the same time, I will tell you, not about Shlomo, but about human nature in general. The observation I've made over my many years on this planet is that there's a difference between intelligence as we think of it in terms of the brain and traits and characteristics of the soul, right? The Rambam makes that point when he talks about what makes a prophet. A person can be absolutely out of this world brilliant, but not on the ball when it comes to just character. And it's possible that he makes that mistake. He's enthralled with his wisdom. I don't know.
Is it possible that this